This is The Takeaway for May 20th. I'm Tanzina Vega. The situation at the border is getting worse, especially in El Paso, Texas.
There have been people that at times have been detained under a bridge in a fenced area in smaller military-style tents. And now there is a larger 500-person tent that's in operation there.
Also on the show, we've got a new series for you. It's called The Juggle, Navigating Life in Your 40s. Today, money.
One thing that we don't think about as much is aging parents. And if you're supporting them or helping them in any way, you're sort of stuck between all these different drains on your finances. And it can be exhausting.
We're talking about life in your 40s all week, and we've been hearing from you.
My struggle that decade was just trying to find work and earn enough income.
So I just had to immediately and quickly cut expenses and payments.
I stopped being nice and stopped apologizing when I don't need to. I set boundaries.
Plus, the prospect of a fur ban in New York City drives conversation about communities, and Laura Dern joins us to talk about her new project. Busy Monday, everybody. Let's get to it. Since December, 5 migrant children have died after being detained by U.S. immigration agencies. The latest death came today, when a 16-year-old Guatemalan migrant died at a border patrol station in South Texas. The teen's cause of death is not yet known. Last Tuesday, a 2.5-year-old boy from Guatemala died in an El Paso hospital, just over a month after being released from Customs and Border Protection custody. He had been diagnosed with pneumonia shortly after entering the United States with his mother. These recent deaths come as CBP apprehensions at the southern border continue to rise, outpacing totals for 2018. Nearly 99,000 migrants were apprehended last month. That number of people would fill a football stadium. Meanwhile, CNN published photographs of migrants, including children, in a McAllen, Texas Border Patrol station sleeping on the ground using Mylar blankets as shelter. As immigration agencies defer to Congress to act, conditions in migrant detention centers appear unlikely to improve in the immediate future. We spoke earlier today with Noman Merchant, an immigration reporter for the Associated Press, before the news of the most recent death. I asked Noman what we know about the 2-year-old who died last week.
We know that the boy and his mother entered the United States near a bridge in El Paso, Texas, in early April, and that 3 days after the Border Patrol says it apprehended the boy and his mother, the mother reported her son being sick. The Border Patrol says it took the boy to a hospital that day and transferred him to a children's hospital the next day and technically released the boy and his mother from their custody a few days later. And the boy was hospitalized for about a month before succumbing to pneumonia.
We know that there was another child, 8-year-old Felipe Gonzalez Alonso, who died in December. Department of Homeland Security said it would change some of its medical check policies. I'm wondering if those have happened so far.
That's right. After Felipe's death, that was the second in December of a child from Guatemala in the Border Patrol's custody. The agency said that it would institute medical screenings for all of the children in its custody and expand the screenings that it was doing for children that were coming in. We don't know the results of what screenings may have occurred in this case of the 2-year-old who died. And we know that El Paso is one of the places that has been particularly overwhelmed by the surge of families that are crossing the border. There have been people that at times have been detained under a bridge in a fenced area in smaller military-style tents. And now there is a larger 500-person tent that's in operation there. But even with that tent, there's still a lot more people than there are facilities to hold them.
Last month, there were a little less than 100,000 migrants apprehended at the southern border. What do we know about the daily conditions at CBP facilities right now in Texas?
We know that in many parts of Texas, particularly in El Paso and the Rio Grande Valley, which is at the southernmost point of Texas, the Border Patrol stations and the processing center are all overwhelmed. They're all above capacity. In the Rio Grande Valley, for example, there are about 8,000 people detained in a sector that has space for 3,300 people. Then you add the 500-person tent, and even then, that doesn't cover half of the number of people that Border Patrol is detaining. And so, as you alluded to, CNN published some photos from inside the McAllen Border Patrol station. Border Patrol itself released some photos because they want to call attention to what they say is a crisis here. And you can see children and parents lying outside on grass or in these smaller military-style tents with just Mylar foil blankets as protection. And in South Texas, it's already above 90 degrees every day. People are waiting out there for hours, and there isn't capacity to hold them and to keep them in conditions that everybody would agree were safe.
The federal government has started putting up more tent facilities to hold migrants in Texas. Are those conditions any better?
Yeah, they opened two tents, one in El Paso and one in South Texas in the port city of Donna. Inside, there's space for mats. There are bathrooms, porta potties. There's showers. There's air conditioning, which is a big deal given the weather. It's not ideal as a place to keep a child for any significant amount of time, but it is better than some of the conditions that people are being detained in, as you can see in photos that were released even after this tent were open, photos that were released outside of Border Patrol stations where people are sleeping in parking lots and on grass.
I want to go back a second to the photos that CNN published last week. You're not with CNN, obviously, you're with the Associated Press, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about when you're reporting and sometimes photographing migrant populations. There's a little bit of a controversy over whether those photos should have blurred the images of the people who were in them.
It's very difficult, and I don't want to weigh in on CNN's decisions on how they publish those photos. I will say that when we interview families that have just crossed the border or families that have been processed and are ready to go to their ultimate destination in other parts of the country, we'll ask them and we'll try and explain to them, we want to use your name, we want to use your identity, and these photos will be distributed to tell this story. And most of the time, families are completely aware of that. You do have to be very careful about willing or unwilling exploitation, but it's difficult because the photos also have very important news value, and it's something that we struggle with.
So the Takeaway reached out to Customs and Border Protection about this segment, and I want to read part of the statement they sent us from their acting commissioner, John P. Sanders, and I'm quoting here. We are using every resource available to cope with this worsening emergency. I'm asking Congress to act to help us address this national emergency. So does Congress need to act to solve the situation at the border, or can the Trump administration take action on its own?
That's a really difficult question. And without weighing into the policy debate that's happening, the numbers are hitting records for Border Patrol of families that are crossing the border. And you have these facilities that were not built to detain families that are detaining hundreds or thousands of them at a time. And so there's this big resource gap. You have Border Patrol agents who are being placed in this position to provide water bottles, to do diaper changes, to help people with humanitarian needs that Border Patrol agents are, you know, by and large, the ones that I've met, they're willing to do that. They want to help people, but at the same time, they're law enforcement agents. You have this big gap, and the Trump administration is talking about policy changes that would essentially make it easier to detain migrant families for longer and speed up deportations. And that's something that House Democrats have opposed. And I think there's this big gap in what Democrats and Republicans in the Trump administration would agree to. But I think we can all agree that having parents sleep outside with their children is not something that anybody in America wants. And there's a lot of ways that that could be addressed, and there's got to be some common ground on that.
Noman Merchant is an immigration reporter for the Associated Press. We appreciate your time, Noman.
Thank you.
New York City is considering a law that would ban the sale of fur. Corey Johnson, who is the speaker of the city council, explained to WNYC's Brian Lehrer back in April why this ban was a priority for New York City lawmakers.
When we've investigated how fur comes to be, the killing of animals through metal traps, through gassing, through fur farms, that it is cruel and inhumane. I think New York City should follow the lead of San Francisco and Los Angeles and other cities and other countries across Europe who've said this is not the way to go about it. And I want to try to have New York City to be a more humane city.
Concerns about animal rights and the ethics of selling fur have led New York on the same path as cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, who have already put in place their own versions of a fur ban. But like so many issues in New York, this attempt to change a piece of the city's identity has drawn a backlash from a diverse group of opponents. Joining me now with more is Tanisha C. Ford, Associate Professor of Africana Studies and History at the University of Delaware. Tanisha, thanks for joining us.
Hello.
So let's talk a little bit about the role the fur industry has had in just like building the basic economy of the of New York City and also more broadly in the country.
Yes, New York City has been a major player in the fur trade since the 17th century. It was a thriving trade post where raw pelts were sold and used to fabricate goods in Europe and other luxury industries around the world. And in the 1950s, we see this expansion in the American market during the early years of the Cold War when the U.S. fur traders ban the sale of or the import of seven different types of pelts from Russia in order to expand the U.S. market. And so we see cities like New York, of course, but also Detroit, Chicago, and Los Angeles becoming major retailers for fur. But then states like Wisconsin, Utah, Idaho, Oregon, and Minnesota becoming major places that farm furs such as sable and mink. Particularly.
How long has fur been politicized?
Well, it's long been political. Parts of this have to do with class issues. So back in the day, in the 50s and 60s, when fur was really at its peak in popularity in the United States, you know, one who was extremely wealthy would go to a place like Bergdorf's and sip champagne while models modeled the latest styles in fur. So there were definitely these real class dynamics related to fur that only really the 1% could afford to buy this luxury good. But then in the 1980s, we see a different kind of conversation really take center stage around the politics of fur. And that's around the time that PETA was founded. And animal rights activists really started to amplify their voices and say that actually the murder of animals to produce this very vanity-driven luxury good is quite inhumane. And they would show images of mink and other animals, including fox and raccoons being electrocuted, skinned alive. I remember in the 1990s, in particular, when chinchilla furs were extremely popular, particularly among hip-hop artists and other entertainers, that they would post messages that really described how 150 chinchillas would have to be killed for a full-length coat. So there's this long tension around both the class politics but also the treatment of animals that's really been amplified in recent decades as the sustainability movement and animal rights movement has taken another turn in the United States and abroad.
Tanisha, we've heard the fight about animal rights and animal treatment for very long. I'm wondering why fur is such a target when you think about other things like leather or meat.
Right. So I think that there's a way that both meat and leather are seen as more practical goods. That, of course, there's a very strong vegan movement in our country, but it's the way that we think of meat as being, you know, an option for people, or leather. It's not just about wearing the flashiest leather coat, but about wearing, you know, a practical good. You know, you need a leather wallet or a leather belt or leather sneakers. But fur has been seen as something that's completely frivolous by many. Of course, that there have been people who've pushed back against this notion of frivolity and have linked it to very important religious traditions. Particularly, I'm thinking of Hasidic Jews who wear fur hats as part of their religious observances. I'm thinking of Black ministers who have spoken out about the fact that wearing fur has long been a part of African-American fashion and style traditions. And so there's this way that fur is targeted because it's seen as this luxury item. But the reality is that particularly today, and I would say since the 1970s, when fur started to decline in cost and made it possible for more working class people to own fur, that really this idea of it as this extreme luxury good has changed as well. So it's kind of like a debate where many people feel like we're punishing working class people and people from historically marginalized groups for wanting to wear a good that for decades they couldn't even have gain access into this luxury market to buy.
I mean, we know that fur plays a big role in Black communities. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Yeah, so there's this concept of styling out, which has been important to African Americans since enslavement, really, where their clothing choices were greatly restricted by plantation owners who determined what they would wear to labor in, which is usually cheap fabrics like denim and Osnaburg. So this idea of then being able to choose what to wear to church on Sunday, to wear for special occasions, became a great part of African-American self-expression. I'm thinking about a famous photo from the 1930s of two African-Americans wearing raccoon full-length furs. And it speaks to that idea of finally having the freedom to adorn ourselves the way that we choose. And that sense of styling out remains an important part of our cultural conversation around dress and identity. And that's why you could see someone like the hip-hop star and reality television star Safari Samuels is outside also with the protesters speaking out against his right to wear fur, saying things like our fur, our right. And another part of this debate for African Americans is like, you know, of course we care about animals, but what about the ways that we are treated inhumanely in this country? And so that's another tension and another important part of this conversation around fur. It's about, you know, not just about fur itself, it's about our desire and our need and our right to protect ourselves and our own community. So who are the people who are speaking out for us, fighting for our rights, to protect our right to live against state violence in places like New York City?
Tanisha Ford is an associate professor of Africana Studies and History at the University of Delaware. Tanisha, thank you.
Thank you.
If you're in your 40s and you're more tired than you've ever been because you're juggling life, work, money, aging parents,
aging yourself,
relationships,
not wanting to play games anymore, etc.,
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 raise your hand. How are you coping? Well, I tweeted that last week, and boy, did I get a response.
I'm 48 and my husband is 60, and our biggest financial challenge is making ends meet and still be able to save money for college and retirement.
Well, the first one was divorce. Second one was college tuition for three children. Vacations were few and far between, and if they were at all, they were fairly local.
I lost a job at the height of the financial crisis in 2010, back in my mid-40s. So I just had to immediately and quickly cut expenses and payments.
It took me 17 years to get my undergraduate degree after raising kids and working full-time jobs.
My biggest financial challenge in my 40s has been tackling the overwhelming credit card debt I built up in my 30s.
So many of you rose your virtual hands to tell us that your 40s are full of pitfalls and stressors. But also, there's some really great stuff about your 40s and some really great ways of coping.
I stopped being nice and stopped apologizing when I don't need to. I set boundaries.
Increasing my percentage put into my 401k annually. I also deposit a certain amount of money into a savings account every 2 weeks.
Simply a frugal lifestyle.
I just want to say education opens doors to wages that lift families out of poverty.
So over the next few days, here's what we're going to do. We're going to dig into life in your 40s and what makes this decade so unique. We're going to call it the juggle. And let me tell you, the juggle is real. One of our Twitter followers actually said that line, and I love it. So we're going to hashtag it, the juggle is real. And if you're not quite in your 40s yet, or you've already been there, done that, we see you too. Come along for the ride with us. So we're going to take on something a lot of you tweeted at me about, money. In your 40s, financial pressures and challenges are different than before. And Arielle O'Shea is an investment and retirement specialist for NerdWallet, and she's going to talk us through it. Welcome, Arielle.
Hi, how are you?
All right. So what makes your 40s a unique time in terms of personal finance? How do you see this decade?
I think everything sort of adds up in terms of thy financial pressures. If you have children, you may be having childcare expenses. And then along with that, you may be wanting to save for their college at the same time. And then your own retirement, you're wanting to save for that. And if you didn't do a very good job of that when you were younger, and many of us didn't, then it feels like you have a lot of pressure right now to catch up. And then there are other goals, you know, home buying, things like that. And then, you know, one thing that we don't think about as much is aging parents. And if you're supporting them or helping them in any way, you're sort of stuck between all these different drains on your finances, and it can be exhausting.
Let's talk a little bit about how much people make, so our income, which is different than how much wealth people have, which we won't depress anybody with right now. In your 40s, where are we in terms of earning potential?
The interesting thing about this is that it is different for men and women. So according to PayScale, men actually peak in their early 50s and women peak much earlier, about 10 years earlier, in their early 40s.
Wait, in other words, this is it?
This is it. Yep. If you're a woman, you may have already had your income peak, which is pretty sad.
Do we know anything about why that is, Ariel, or is it just good old, you know, institutional issues?
I think it's institutional issues. I mean, I think a lot of the issues, you know, the differences between men and women have to do with the career breaks that women tend to take earlier on in their careers that men don't take. So they may be missing out on bonuses and pay raises and promotions and career growth. It's all these issues that we talk about all the time with wage inequality. Same thing is happening here with wage peaking.
What are some of the primary drains on financial resources during one's 40s? I'm thinking home ownership, student loans, God forbid.
Yeah, home ownership, student loans. I mean, about 20% of this generation are still paying down one or more student loans. Some of them with older children may be either, you know, paying for college, paying off student loans for their children, they're saving for college. So all of those things. And then again, you know, if you're helping parents, you're trying to save for your own retirement. It's really this, you know, they call it the sandwich generation, and it really feels like a sandwich.
You know, one of the things also in the narrative around money is we hear a lot about millennials who say that they find it difficult to save. They're not getting paid enough. They can't do things like buy homes. But I think we also need to look at Gen X, and I mean specifically people in their 40s, but even beyond Gen X, and look at how this generation is also saddled with debt, right? I think some of your data showed that Generation X has about as much credit card debt as millennials do.
Yeah, it's similar to millennials. So about 2/3 have credit card debt. That's roughly the same as millennials. It's higher than baby boomers. And you know, what was interesting is that they owe the highest credit card balances, and more of Generation X has made a late payment on their credit cards than any other generation. So I think that is a result of financial struggles and, you know, not having the money to come up to pay off the debt. But it's also the result of like so many different things on your time that you're forgetting because you have to take the kids to school and to take the kids to daycare and you have this work, and all these different things really add up in this decade.
And one of the things that strikes me is that we have less time to fix those things.
Yeah, I mean, it's about, you know, the halfway point of your career, and you really have to think about getting some of these things on track for sure.
Let's take a listen to one of our callers who shared her experience about life in her 40s with money.
Hi, this is Linda from Vancouver, Washington. In my 40s, I was laid off from a high-tech job just 6 months after I bought my house. So my struggle that decade was just trying to find work and earn enough income without dipping into my 401k, which I was not successful at. But I did make it to 16 years later when I finally ended up selling that house and buying another one. So I made it, but it was not easy being a single woman.
Well, first of all, Ariel, kudos to Linda, because that's a lot to do. But also, I want to talk about two things Linda brings up. Number one, layoffs. People in their 40s are starting to deal with, I think, ageism at this point. How big of a deal is job security at this stage?
I think it's a big deal. I mean, I think it's one of these things where you don't feel like you should, you know, it feels like ageism is something for much older people when you're in your 40s. You don't feel like it should affect you. But in reality, it can. I mean, you know, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act protects workers 40 and over for a reason. That's because, you know, that's when age discrimination can start to happen. And so it's something certainly that you want to be aware of.
Let's talk about some positive things, Ariel, that 40-somethings can do, whether they're married, single, kids, no kids. What are some things that, given the realities of this decade, and the current realities of where we are today, that this generation can start to do to feel more financially secure?
I think the most important thing that you can do is realize that it is not too late you're right in the middle of your life. As Linda said, she made it, right? So you're going to get through this rocky time if you're feeling like it's a rocky time. And it's not too late to turn things around. So if you haven't saved enough for retirement, you still have 20, 25, 30 years to build that retirement savings before, you know, the age when most people tend to want a retirement. And so it's really about making the decisions now that can make up for some of the decisions that maybe you didn't make quite as well earlier. And so it's saving as much as you can. I mean, we talked about pensions and how people in their 40s and earlier generations don't have them. But what we do have is these Roth IRA accounts, which are great ways to save money and earn your earnings grow tax-free, which is something that our parents didn't have. So take advantage of the perks that we have.
Arielle O'Shea is investing and retirement specialist for NerdWallet. Thank you for being with us, Arielle.
Thank you.
On the morning of December 23, 1991, in the town of Corsicana, Texas, a fire destroyed the home of Cameron Todd Willingham and his wife, Stacy. All three of their young children died in the fire. After local authorities determined that Willingham had deliberately started the fire and charged him with triple homicide, a jury sentenced him to death. And then, while Willingham was on death row, a woman named Elizabeth Gilbert struck up a friendship with him. And she ended up uncovering extensive evidence that suggested Willingham was not guilty of the crime and that the fire had started accidentally. Despite that new evidence, the state of Texas executed Willingham in 2004. Here's then-Governor Rick Perry speaking about the case in 2010.
I'm very comfortable that the science was right. Good and that the justice dispense was good.
Right.
And that we don't have and have not executed an innocent person. Right.
Trial by Fire is a new movie released last week, and it tells Willingham's story. Actor Laura Dern plays Gilbert in the film. I sat down with Dern and screenwriter Jeffrey Fletcher to talk about the movie, and we started out by discussing their choice not to shy away from Willingham's personal flaws, including a history of domestic abuse.
To trust that part of the storytelling, to never pull back and never try to make him into something that he wasn't, allows us as an audience to do what so many do every day with wrongful incarceration, profiling people of color and profiling people who are in extreme poverty and can't fight back and can't defend themselves. And so we as an audience we're already making judgments from the get-go. And one judgment does not lead to atrocity, you know? And it's a really interesting position to put us in, I think.
Was part of it I'll ask both of you, wanting to reshape perceptions of the death penalty itself and who it affects? Because in this case, there is evidence that Willingham may have been innocent. So was that part of the thinking behind it?
I believe the evidence also points to the fact that the death penalty is administered unfairly, and this story presented an opportunity for all of us to examine our impulse to assume guilt and all those prejudices involved. You know, as Brian Stevenson, the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, said, "We have a system of justice that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent."
What if you're black?
Oh, yeah.
We know that that's an added part of the equation, right? I mean, because black inmates make up a disproportionate amount of death row inmates, did that factor into you're thinking about whether to focus on this particular story, on Todd's story?
Well, Todd's story is considered a landmark death penalty case because of Justice Scalia's comments. You know, when Todd was executed in 2004 and 2006, Justice Scalia famously wrote, "There was no reason to think that an innocent person had ever been executed because, quote, if such an event had occurred in recent years, we would not have to hunt for it. The innocent's name would be shouted from the rooftops by the abolition lobby."
And to Justice Scalia's comment, the Innocence Project alone has shouted from the rooftops that they've been involved in exonerating 374 people with DNA evidence have been proven innocent who were about to be killed on death row. So what has been proven is there is a margin of human error. And if there is a margin of human error, then per Justice Scalia, we must abolish capital punishment because they've said we would never kill an innocent person or we wouldn't have it. So we can't have it. And we, hopefully, we all just can continue a deeper conversation so that we wrestle with our own morality when we look at the choices we have to make and stand up and use our voice when we see injustice.
And injustice is something that we are seeing, I think, quite a bit in society. I think, you know, many of us in the past couple of years, you know, have really looked at these issues and really felt sort of overwhelmed. And one of those things has been the Me Too movement. Laura, you've done a lot of work to end sexual harassment in Hollywood. It's been hard to believe, but it's been almost 2 years since the Harvey Weinstein story first broke. Do you think there has been enough progress made in this issue?
There's never enough progress. We have so much work to do. But authentically being in your voice and sharing your story is the most extraordinary gift you can give humanity, culture, your own healing. And I so respect someone who, from their own trauma, needs to remain private. And that is a brave choice. And it is such a brave choice to stand up and be vocal and name names when you have been sexually harassed or assaulted. And the people who've come forward, men and women, have been extraordinary. And I think within our industry, there is a lot of change. I've been working closely with Screen Actors Guild on a code of conduct. All companies now have a very new code of conduct in terms of expected behavior on set and in the audition process. And I think across all industries, what we're seeing is there is a new level of expected behavior. And abuse of power is not going to fly. But we need to stand together with that mantra.
Want to switch gears just a little bit. Women over a certain age, we're getting used to seeing them on camera and maybe even behind the camera, right? Laura, you've worked in Hollywood for a very long time. Are you seeing that shift? Is age now becoming less of an issue in Hollywood?
I don't think it's less of an issue. Mm-hmm. I just think we're breaking the doors down and we're not going anywhere. So they're just going to have to get used to us. Mm. But I think what's also changing it is, you know, there's so much access to content. And therefore, we're not just looking at a Nielsen rating to tell us who our audience is. We have people watching content in all kinds of mediums and accessing it in so many ways. And now we're getting new and very interesting numbers. And guess what, guys? Women over 40 are high consumers. They are buying your products. They are watching your shows. And they go to the movies. And what we are learning is whether you're selling movies or you're making and selling a product or you're running a restaurant, people want to be seen and heard in this world. And without representation, you fail, you don't make as much money, you don't have a successful boardroom, your stocks go down. If you only are doing it for money, as my daughter who's 14 says, Mom, I don't care. I'm a mixed race girl. If I get in certain rooms because of shame, I'm really comfortable with that. Yeah. Like, I just love the idea that if people are waking up and their goal for representation in their company is it's better for the company, it's better business to have representation, then so be it.
Absolutely. And I always think of Hollywood as a bottom line driven business. But if you look at it, if that is the case, you look at the return on investment from films like Straight Outta Compton, Get Out, Black Panther, Girls Trip, and on and on. And so you have to make these projects to satisfy supply and demand. But to do it authentically, you have to have diversity behind the camera as well. You know, within an audience, there are lie detectors. You cannot get around it.
I want to just get one question in, Jeffrey, sort of taking a little bit of a tangent here. It's about John Singleton, who was a mentor to you early in your career. He just passed away. He was just 51 years old. I'm wondering if you would want to share with us what the loss means to you. I know you've written about this as well.
Yes. We weren't that far apart in age. And he was a fully realized man from so early on. Genuinely wanted to help the industry reach its potential in terms of opportunity in different voices. To whatever degree I'm a discovery, he really discovered me. And I feel like he gave me the chance of a lifetime. And I just wasn't ready for it at the time. He kept his door open to me. And it all started because he saw a short film that I had made in film school. And he wanted to produce the feature version of that with me writing and directing it. And it always bothered me that I wasn't ready. And it bothers me to this day because I feel like I let him down. And shortly before he passed away, I had a project that I wanted to present to him. And you can tell a lot about a person when you almost work with him. Always gracious throughout the years. I'd reach out to him, and his door was always open.
Jeffrey Fletcher is a screenwriter for Trial by Fire, and Laura Dern stars in the film. Thank you both for coming and sharing with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Honored to be here.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.